Hello and welcome to this little preview of What is Past, as well as a prelude for what is to come. For the last year or so, I have been recording with the Hamlet to Hamilton podcast to explore Anglophone verse drama. Over on their show, I have been sharing snippets of plays from the dawn of English drama up to 1558. And generally pontificating off the top of my head, some slightly unsubstantiated opinions. It was super fun, and I heartily recommend that you go over to their podcast and catch the series, not least because it continues here on the Beyond feed in a couple of weeks' time, when we explore in the same ways plays from the 1560s and the 1570s. And to get you in the mood, the good folks of Hamlet to Hamilton have shared the last episode we recorded as a teaser. So here's a bit of their last episode to whet your appetite for the next episode and the previous episodes before we go off to Hamlet to Hamilton land. Enjoy!
This is Hamlet to Hamilton, Exploring Verse Drama. I'm your host, Emily C.A. Snyder. You're listening to Season 4, Episode 10, From Edward to Elizabeth.
To be.
To be.
Or not to be.
To be or not to be.
That is the question.
Or not.
Hello, friends. Welcome to our final episode of Season 4. Well, final episode, sort of. It's the final episode that we are hosting here on our feed, Hamlet to Hamilton, but we're going to be continuing on into 14ers and blank verse, no rhyme, what? And all sorts of goodies that happen as things alter and change in English drama from the 1560s to the 1570s. But today we're going to rush through several monarchs, Edward and Mary and Elizabeth, and see the differences, basically, between the plays for them. We are joined, as always this season, with Rob Crichton of the Beyond Shakespeare Company podcast. And we are so grateful that Rob proposed this season, this joint season between our different podcasts. And it's been such a delight to record with him and to walk through in this season four, the beginnings, the origins of Anglophone verse drama. And if you subscribe now to the Beyond Shakespeare Company podcast, you'll be hearing the first paragraph English drama very soon after this episode. Very exciting stuff. All right. A little bit of a content warning to begin with. We talk about a gentleman named Udall, a playwright named Udall, and at the end of talking about his play, so we'll talk about all of it, and then we do very briefly mention that he has allegations of sexual impropriety. So if you get to that and you want to skip over hearing a wee bit about it, skip over about a minute. And then at the very end of the episode, we do talk about masks, and we talk about the mask of cats that Edward had. And we do talk about, sadly, the cats that lost their lives to some costuming. So if that is not for you, then go ahead and end the episode just a wee bit early. And I promise you will have heard everything else, and you don't need to hear that. Our episode, our season, is brought to you by our patrons on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Hamlet to Hamilton. We have a Discord server, and we have a lot of gratitude. Thank you guys so much for being so wonderful. You can, of course, join us over there. We would love to have you. You can find out more at hamlettohamilton.com. If you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed to the Beyond Shakespeare Company podcast. You can find out more about them at beyondshakespeare.org or on their Twitter at beyondshakes. It has been a delight to do this season, and I'm excited for today's final episode. I think you'll very much enjoy it. And just a huge shout out as well. Make sure, if you haven't already, give Colin his flowers, because this entire season he's had to edit together three different voices over hours and hours and hours of recording. And that's a lot of work. And my understanding, because I'm not the one that edits, I just talk, is that it's a lot more work to put three voices together. But we did it. Colin did it. It's been amazing to have Rob. And let's get into our final episode on our channel before we head on over to the Beyond Shakes channel. All right, here we go.
We may be too giggly.
No, we're fine.
This is exactly the right mood to enter the world of John Bale.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, even better.
That's exactly right. So John Hayward, I said earlier, was this, you know, very genial chap who was, you know, he was of the Catholic confession, but he was very much a conciliator. He was very reasonable. John Bale is a hard right evangelical firebrand.
Oh, no.
He is utterly opposed to all things that involves any level of popery, anything. He is absolutely not the person to invite round for dinner. He is really important to us because he collected plays, he wrote plays, he collected books, and his accounts of books that existed are so important to us, even though they're lost, specifically because they're lost, but he catalogued them. And so when he rises to prominence, and he rises to prominence under Thomas Cromwell, and he is basically running Thomas Cromwell's players.
I'm sorry, is he the propagandist for Cromwell?
Yeah, basically. Briefly, that is sort of his job.
Actually, some historical context, because I did not realize Cromwell had players. I thought theatre was just band, but
you're thinking Oliver Cromwell later on.
Yes, this is Cromwell.
Thomas Cromwell of Wolf Hall fame. Because by this point, I say there are lots of various interlude companies. Many of them are sponsored by wealthy patrons. The king has players of his own, and you know, the evangelical school is using everything it can to promote a new way of looking at the world. And John Bale,
are they evangelical about it?
they're really quite firebrandy about it. So John Bale basically writes a Protestant mystery cycle. So we're at a time where mystery plays are being rewritten or starting to be rewritten. It's something where, you know, basically doctrine is now getting complicated. And so you've got plays that you've been performing for hundreds of years, and people are saying, well, maybe I need to tweak that bit. Maybe we shouldn't talk about the Virgin Mary so much, because none of that's in the Bible, you know. And so you see this in scripts for plays from, say, the Chester cycle that survives. Most of the scripts for Chester are late Tudor, even early Stuart transcriptions. And most of the ones the documents that survive are post-Reformation. So we have a pre-Reformation bans that tell us what plays were featured. But we also have post-Reformation bans, and we have the scripts that we have. And I say there's clearly been an attempt to tidy up the theology. And John Bale basically started from scratch. And we've got three of his explicitly Protestant mystery plays, God's Promises, The Baptism, and The Temptation.
Mm.
He also wrote a sort of combination of that, a sort of morality play slash look at the Old Testament prophets in a play called Three Laws.
Mm.
And when I'm saying he's hard right, he is against everything, especially sodomitry as well. So he is not a nice guy in many ways. There are lots of suggestions that is in his Carmelite education that there might even be some bad things happen to Bale. That is a very much an interpretive thing. Yeah, the guy was obsessed. I think that's maybe a bit maybe I'm pushing that too far, but he had issues. And he was definitely paranoid as well. He thought people were trying to kill him. And that's because sometimes they were.
That's not paranoid if it's true.
Well, he writes a very interesting account of him going to Ireland. He's made Bishop of Ossory during the reign of Edward the Sixth. Mm-hmm. And so he goes over there and basically tells everyone that they're wrong and they shouldn't be. Goes to Ireland and tells them to be more Protestant and puts on his religious plays, the ones that survive, God's Promises, the Baptism, and the Temptation. And he does this on the day of the accession of Mary.
What?
The point at which the safety net underneath him has just been yanked away as a Catholic monarch has come to the throne, and he's putting on Protestant mystery plays.
Mm.
He gets
on the feast of the Assumption.
Accession of Mary.
Oh, accession.
Queen Mary has come to the throne, a Catholic monarch, and of course the question of how much sway. English monarchs have over Ireland at this point is pretty minimal in many ways, but it's a complicated thing.
Always a thorny question.
So so he thinks he's being poisoned. People are trying to poison him. People are trying to kill him. And in fact, there does seem to be an incident a couple of days after this performance, which is it three or five of his servants are killed.
Whoa!
He escapes. He loses his books and escapes and he's captured by pirates. And
are you serious? You're not?
I am not making this up. I mean, this is, of course, his account, how actually exciting this was. But he goes into exile and he's doing these plays. So the plays he starts writing under Thomas Cromwell, obviously Cromwell falls end of the 1530s. Mm-hmm. He's sort of bimbling around, I think, under Harry. He really leaps to the fray during Edward's reign and then goes into exile. And then he comes back under Elizabeth going, hey, look at me, I'm this great Protestant propagandist. And Elizabeth goes, yeah, we're really not doing that anymore. Please stop. Huh. And so he's another one of these thwarted playwrights because he spends basically 10, 20 years working on this play, King John, which people will have heard of.
There's
an early version from the 1530s and there's a later reworking and there's complicated textual issues go on. And it's similar in tone to Albion Night because you've got a virtuous... in this universe, a virtuous king who is poisoned. Again, autobiography from Bale there. You've got...
Well, no, but they kind of do that in the Duckman's John...
John Peel's version, yes. As then later adapted by
an upstart from Warwickshire. Mm. Anyway, go ahead. So
you've got you've got Widow England who is there turning up to King John saying we're under attack by terrible forces.
I see.
And then you've got a vice sedition who turns up who is the bad person. So we have this. This is the opening of the play, and so it's one that people may have heard of if they know about this period a bit. It's a reasonably well known. It's the first sort of history play that we have. It's a sort of mixture of morality play and history play. It does an interesting combination of the two. And of course, from a Protestant point of view, King John is a great hero.
Huh.
Because he stood up to the Pope.
Sure.
Right. Right.
And so that's the logic of the play. So whereas we think of King John as being either ineffectual or a terrible king, a tricksy character who fights Robin Hood, he's actually sort of cast as a kind of hero figure.
And there's no Robin Hood in this one, is that correct?
Oh, no, absolutely no. Okay. It's all about defying Rome and then getting poisoned by priests by monks at the end.
Okay.
But here is it's bad things are happening in the kingdom. Who fancies being King John? Who fancies being Widow England or sedition? I was going to pop in as sedition.
Why don't you pop in as sedition? Actually, could I be journalist? You want to be John, Colin? That'd be okay.
Please take it away.
Okay,
be my guest.
Cool. Okay.
Oh, who should be England? Are we going
that's
that
you.
Far? Oh, that's me now? Okay, great.
Yeah. Ça va?
Great.
Okay. So, this is Act One. So is this the very beginning?
This is the very opening of the play. It gives us a reasonable selection of his verse style.
So we have missed nothing. Okay.
Nothing at all.
Right. Trumpets happen. In comes King John. He says
there are no indications of trumpets in the text.
Well, fine, but you don't necessarily have a curtain or lights either. So I just presume everything, especially if a king is coming on, begins with an alarum of some ilk.
Well, the play doubles to five or six actors, so there might not have been anyone spare to do a trumpet.
Okay, so I will come on blowing my own horn.
Unannounced.
Here we go. Oh, sorry. This is already doing what makes me frustrated. King John is starting his own play with a soliloquy. All right, here we go. But you don't know that. So someone comes on without trumpets. It just
there
starts.
Be trumpets. I'm just clarifying. There is no stage direction from the period.
It just says, to declare the powers and their force to enlarge, the scripture of God doth flow in most abundance, and of sophisters, the cottles to discharge, both Peter and Paul make plenteous utterance. How that all people should show their true allegiance to their lawful king, Christ Jesus doth consent, which to the high powers was ever obedient. To show what I am, I think it convenient. John, King of England, the chronicles doth me call. My grandfather was an emperor excellent, my father a king by succession lineal. A king, my brother, like as to him did fall, Richard Coeur de Lion, they called him in France, which had over enemies most fortunable chance, by the will of God and his high ordinance. In Ireland, in Wales, in Anjou, and Normandy, in England also, I have had the governance. I have worn the crown and wrought victoriously, and now do purpose, by practice and by study, to reform the laws and set men in good order, that true justice may be had in every border.
Enter England.
Then I trust your grace will weigh a poor widow's cause. Ungodly used, as ye shall know, in short clause.
Yea, that I will swear, if it be true and just.
Like as it beareth truth, so let it be discussed.
Then, gentle widow, tell me what the matter is.
Alas, your clergy hath done very sore amiss in misusing me against all right and justice, and for my more grief thereto, they other entice.
Whom do they entice for to do the injury?
Such as hath entered by false hypocrisy. Hypocrisy. Hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Injury.
Yeah, that's a neat one.
Sorry. For
injury,
to do the injury. Do you feel better? Would you like to say hypocrisy?
No. Sorry.
Okay.
Much worse fruits having than hath the thorns unpleasant, for they are the trees that God did never plant. And as Christ doth say, blind leaders of the blind.
Tell me whom thou meanest, to satisfy my mind.
Such lubbers as hath disguised heads in their hoods, which in idleness do live by other men's goods, monks, canons, and nuns, in divers color and shape, both white, black, and pied, God send their increase ill hap.
Let me know thy name, pardon me, let me know thy name, or I go further with thee.
England, sir, England my name is. Ye may trust me.
I marvel right sore how thou comest changed thus.
Enter sedition.
Ooh.
What, you two alone? I will tell tales by Jesus, and say that I see you fall here to obituary.
Avoid, lewd person, for thy words are ungodly.
I cry you mercy, sir. Pray you be not angry. By my faith and truth, I came hither to be merry.
Thou canst with thy mirth in no wise discontent me, so that thou powder it with wisdom and honesty.
I am no spicer, by the mass. You may believe me.
I speak of no spice, but of civil honesty.
You spake of powder, by the Holy Trinity.
Not as thou takest it, of a gross capacity, but as St. Paul meaneth unto the Colossians plain. So season your speech that it be without disdain. Now, England, to thee, go thou forth with thy tale, and show the cause why thou lookest so wan and pale.
And there we will pause. Ah. It's a really... I'm not even sure if it's most indicative of his writing style. I think his Temptation is a really excellent play. I think he really managed to make that play work well, and I think his three biblical plays are actually really quite good. Mm. King John, I think, is a play that can be really made. I think there's a lot of good in it. But it does show up some of his party quirks. When he's good, he's good. When he's really pompous, he's really pompous. Every so often, he will use a really lengthy, awkward polysyllable in the middle of a line, and it will all just go a little bit wrong.
Yeah, well, and he was doing some wrenched rhymes in there, which we know, but it was actually really nice to have the longer line, because a good chunk of this is in pentameter, or possibly occasionally more, you know, so it's hanging around pentameter, loose pentameters, let's say.
Yeah, it is a little loose, but it's a lot tighter than the other stuff we've done.
That is true this
time. Yeah.
Right, but it was very nice to have the longer lines, to just sort of get more of a thought, since almost all of this is end stopped. Each line almost is end stopped. Therefore, there's more room to have a full thought, since that's kind of what he's doing. He's schwoomfing per line. He's end stopping per line. Very few enjambments, I think. Just looking at this real quick. Yeah. There's punctuation on almost every line.
Yeah, enjambment was, if there was any, it was by far the exception.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Other men's goods, monks can it. No,
yeah. But even so, that's like, it's a soft stop. It's an understood stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. I will say, you know, that I personally get, if you have the main character come on and start soliloquizing, you don't know who it is. but this is fine insofar as King John then stopped and did essentially function more as a prologue and not as a soliloquy, right? This was an address. This wasn't an interior character
moment. This was not a "now I am alone" thing.
No, I mean, he's got the crown. He's come on and he says, I'm Joel.
Exactly. and I am a goodie.
And it's interesting, he's talking about himself as a historical figure from the past as well.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting, there's something about this play actually that I really like, which turns up later on, which is this sort of way time collapses and then also expands throughout. So, you know, John, King of England, the Chronicles doth me call. So it's like, I'm literally a figure from the Chronicles who has somehow knowledge
this feels, and I mean, his aim, right, is to write to sort of right the wrongs of the medieval time and their work, and this has this really interesting in-between feeling of absolutely being a much more presentational play, you know, where England is allegorical, sedition is there, John is aware that he's an actor in some ways, and of his place in history, right? So there's a sense of, I am coming in, I am putting on the mask in front of you. We're all agreeing to be in a play space. And yet at the same time, not fully necessarily, unless the rest of the play goes there, you don't have to fully engage with actors, you know, creating a second fiction. The mask is very... because it sort of remains in the allegory, in the self-awareness, I should say.
It's an interesting question as well, actually, where these this play might have been performed. Mm. In the sense that the biblical plays are almost certainly designed to be performed outdoors, or maybe in very big spaces. You know, whereas most of the stuff we've done this session have been plays that probably happen indoors in small spaces.
They felt that way too. Yeah, that's interesting.
Whereas this feels much more, I am shouting on a stage outside.
I did feel
interiorary.
That I've taken over the pageant wagon, but with less fun.
Mm. Oh, there is some fun in this. It is a very serious start. Has to be said, and you know, you can see Widow England sort of coming in with a hand over the, you know, just gesturing and
To be honest, I think the seriousness is with the longer lines. You know, as much as I get very like about what everyone says about Shakespeare, and especially how people just like, you know, go to pieces when they think of iambic pentameter. They're not wrong that the longer the line, the more naturalish it sounds, because essentially the closer to the margin it's gotten, the closer to paragraph it's gotten, the longer you're waiting for a line break. And so you've got more time to just sit in it and therefore sort of more time to be serious, particularly if you're still in this I must rhyme thing. You've got more time where you're not rhyming. You have more words that are not being rhymed the longer the line is, if the rhyme is just at the end. So that's just interesting.
It's sort of interesting in between, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the outdoor stuff that I associate with outdoor is stuff that has short lines, and the unit of information is sort of in the stanza.
Yes. Yes.
You know, this stanza is telling me this bit of information. This stanza is telling me this. Whereas this is sort of seems somewhere in between, is in the sense that it's holding on to lengthy thoughts and examples, but it also feels like it actually is an outdoor show.
But you're right, this doesn't
It might not be. I mean, it may be designed to do both, or it just might be he just wants to get that mode, that feel for it.
I feel like it's sort of go either way. Like, I think this could play outdoors or indoors, you know, fairly easily, fairly nimbly. Mm.
But it's not a comedy in that sense. I mean, there are some comedy moments in it. Or at least past...
Well, even Sedition coming on, like, that was rather fun. And also Sedition, wow, like...
Sedition swears a lot immediately. By Jesus. First line, in fact, takes the Lord's name in vain.
Bitchery, like,
bitchery,
dag,
second line,
From John Bale's perspective, you know, the swearing that he does there by the mass. I mean, from Bale's perspective, that's your prop. You know, that is to say he's a wrong'un.
And so, remind me of just the context. So this John Bale, this is the evangelical fellow, and so he is making the most vehement mockery of any papistry,
absolutely.
That he can, correct? Okay, I just want to make sure I was
understanding
the right tone.
So that's what he's doing. I say this date, you know, initially dates to about 1538, towards the very end of, or rattling towards the end of, certainly of Cromwell's time, and to the dying embers of Henry VIII. Okay. But he will keep picking at it until Elizabeth comes to the throne, so it's a complicated text as to which bits go where and when. But he plays around with it for a long time, so that also changes what we think the text is trying to do or where it's supposed to be being performed, because potentially it's being performed in lots of different spaces.
Since you mentioned that, do we have a kind of like written production history through the editions, at least?
Not really. I off the top of my head, I can't remember. Unlike, say, God's Promises, The Baptism, The Temptation, I know it was definitely performed on X date in Ireland on such and such, and probably had a life around that. And the other plays that don't survive probably had some sort of life as well.
Okay.
King John, much less certain of that. It survives in manuscript, whereas the biblical plays actually get printed. I don't think King John gets printed straight away. I'm fairly certain it survives in different manuscript copies.
And manuscript, you mean handwritten?
Yeah. As opposed to getting to the printers, because, say, I'm not so sure about that one getting there. I could be wrong on that point, but I'm fairly certain it starts, it comes to us as as a written down thing rather than actually something that gets printed. But that I will have to check.
So what happens in the rest of this play then? What's his version of King John?
Well, basically he defies the Pope and that's good. The Pope gets angry and arranges for him to get poisoned by monks.
Aha.
And he dies a Protestant martyr. And looks forward to the future monarchs that are going to come after him in a sort of weird blur, collapsy time thing.
Right.
Which certainly in the latest iteration ends effectively with saying, Elizabeth's coming, yay! and that's, and I say, there's some a lot of parody of Catholic priests and services and stuff, and there's an excommunication scene which is quite effective and stuff, which sort of looks forward to the kind of things that Marlowe will do in Faustus with not quite perhaps as OTT.
Do you know was he well received in his own time?
Certainly not in Ireland. I don't get the impression that he was necessarily hugely successful. His reputation, his importance is often more as an antiquarian, as someone who, you know, was writing about texts that we don't have anymore.
Right.
And say he goes into exile and he has a complicated life, and so he writes about himself as well. You know, so some of the stuff when I was saying, you know, the stuff about pirates is true. Well, he tells us that. You know, he tells us he was being poisoned by wicked Catholic people. And, you know, it may be true. Because, frankly, he was a bit of an arsehole. I wouldn't put it necessarily against people. I wouldn't necessarily hold it against them. But obviously, I wouldn't suggest anyone does that, because to people who you don't agree with.
Yeah.
And that is almost it, really, for Henry VIII.
Okay.
We have a play that we're not going to look at, but it's a really interesting play. It's called The Play of Wit and Science. Which has sort of future iterations going down the line. So we might look at that disc further down the line. But but that's basically it. That's we've actually covered most. There's a few more fragments. There's a few other bits and pieces.
So that's Henry, and now we're into
Edward.
And there we leave our little teaser snippet of Hamlet to Hamilton, with past Emily and Colin and myself. The complete episode and the complete series to date can be heard over on the Hamlet to Hamilton podcast feed, found on all good podcatchers. And several bad ones. And we will return to discuss the 1560s with Emily C.A. Snyder in a couple of weeks. Till next time. Goodbye.